Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We still have Kirk with us. So I think, you know, since this is a day where this week and next week, IQR Rasuli gets the 2 weeks off. He's doing a detox from Islam.
That
we may just continue doing what we're doing and continue through the text of this warning, because it is Yahweh's way of gaining our attention. Now, Kirk, do you and I benefit at all from, or anybody that's part of the covenant family benefit from this warning?
Well, absolutely.
And how would we benefit from this warning, since we're not part of Ephraim?
Yeah, but you can warn people. You can tell people what Yahweh said, which is what we're doing. You can certainly remind yourself of what are the consequences for doing things like that. Not that I'm going to rush over to Ephraim's side now, knowing what I know, but you can certainly, plus historically, you can see it in our country. I mean, we have become, we are Ephraim, you know, so it explains a lot about what's going on. And we're so intoxicated with religion and academics and our stupid economy. And I mean, there's no hope. I mean,
I think I agree with you. I think that we benefit in lots of ways. Yeah. One is that this is yet another affirmation that God is warning us that we should not associate with the intoxicating and power-hungry nature of religion.
Yeah, it certainly reinforces what right choice.
Right. So if you know what God is opposed to, isn't that helpful if you're part of his family?
Absolutely.
And it reinforces by seeing what he's opposed to, you get to know him better. Why would he be opposed to these things? Because they're intoxicating. They render you excluded from his family, and they render you incapable of exercising good judgment. That's why he is hostile to this. So couldn't you take the opposite and say, as a member of his covenant family, therefore, if I want to be pleasing to him, if I want to be attracted to him, I ought to disassociate myself from religion, and I ought to do so through exercising good judgment.
Right. What a concept, huh?
Yeah. And that, by the way, since he was speaking negatively against the crown, I ought not, in any way, shape, or form, be beholding to human authority, whether that be military authority, police authority, judicial authority, government authority, religious authority, no matter what the source of authority, I ought not be beholding to human institutionalized authority.
Yeah, you should at least understand these people are, this is a human point of view. It's not God's point of view. So be leery, at least.
Right. And is there a benefit for you and I to be more attractive to God?
Well, sure.
Yeah.
He'll turn to you the minute you start Shemar and Torah.
Right. It's not that he's going to say, you know, that Kirk, he is really attractive to me. Therefore, I'm going to give Kirk more responsibility, more authority, more this, that, and the other thing. But no, wouldn't it be appropriate to view God like he presents himself, and that he's more likely to spend time with, to enjoy the company with, that somebody that's pleasing to him?
Yeah.
Pleasing to be around?
Sure.
So we can gain. Now, that's all selfish gain. I don't think it's really selfish, but it's like saying that you ought to eat right. You ought to eat right and exercise, and that's selfish because you'll feel better. You'll look better and you'll feel better if you eat right and exercise. Okay, but that's self-centered. But isn't there, as you've already mentioned, that's the first thing you said, there is a sense of satisfaction, a sense of accomplishing something that's worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
When you do something that is beneficial for others, even if they don't recognize it.
Right. At least you put the right cards on the table and say, look, this is...
Face up. Here they are.
Yeah.
There's a sense of satisfaction in knowing that you did the right thing for the right reason. And even though they were hostile to you for doing it, that you you laid the cards, Yahweh's cards, face up on the table. And then there's even a growing sense of joy, of satisfaction. knowing that maybe one out of every 100 or maybe it's one out of every 1,000 people that walks by that table with the cards laid face up on the table
would respond correctly.
Yeah, are going to say, wow,
yeah.
That's the game that I want to play. That's the game where there's only winners. There's no gambling there.
No, it's not a gamble. It's a sure thing. Yeah, everybody wants a sure thing.
Yeah, so I want to deal me in.
Cut me in. That's appropriate.
Right. So here we are now in the symbolic meaning. So he's going to say the same thing, but from a pictorial point of view. So he uses a flower, which is the reproduction part of the plant, just as the male genitalia, which is the sign of the covenant circumcision, is the is what he's really talking about here. He's not talking about Ephraim's inability to father children.
No.
He's talking about Ephraim's inability to father children that are part of the covenant. Just as you aren't going to be part of the covenant, you're not circumcised.
Right.
So the flower. And the desirability of and honor of the flower. Hey, do you ever grow roses?
Well, we have them. Terry's the gardener, but yes, we
have
them.
Does she, as a gardener of roses, knows that if you don't clip off the spent rose, that eventually you're going to have no more roses.
That's correct. You do a lot of trimming on roses.
Right. And the reason you trim the rose back and you remove some of the shoots and you clip off the old rose bud is that if you don't, that all of the energy of the rose goes to make that a seed pod. As opposed to going into making another beautiful flower, which is the reproductive origin of the of the rose.
Right.
So sometimes you got to do a little trimming, a little pruning, a little circumcising of the reproductive part of the rose for that rose to continue to be beautiful. If you don't do that, the rose will cease to be attractive. Interesting.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. You have some great insights.
I've spent a lot of time around roses. So then, the flower's desirability and honor. And
right.
I was wondering why Asabi conveyed both things. You know, I could see, because the word was both glory and growth. The word was both splendor and prominence. And you think of women. Splendor and prominence really are very different kinds of things. Glory and growth are different kinds of things. Why would the word be equal parts both things? And then it becomes obvious. The flower is representing an individual's both attractiveness and ability to be part of the covenant. And so the attractiveness is if you're religious and an authority, a leader in religion,
then
being presumptive, then you are no longer attractive. And if you are religious, you're estranged from the covenant. You can't be born anew into the covenant. No bakorum for you. And so when you're born into the covenant, you receive the honor that is being a child of God. You become glorified, really. We become splendorous, prominent, in addition to being attractive and appealing to Yahweh. And, of course, the other interesting part of that word, Sabi, is the signpost for the home as established by Yahweh's outstretched hand, T-S-B-Y, the signpost for the Ba'ath home and family, the covenant, that is established by the outstretched hand of God. To sabi means that your ability to reach out with your hand and grasp something is hindered. So symbolically, the two people standing up, reaching up to Yahweh's outstretched hand in the in His name. There's a breakdown there because the word speaks of those things favorably. It means desirable, honor, the ability to reach up and stretch out and grasp something. But here it's foolishly fading away. what religion will do to it. It's what indoctrination will do to it. It's what human institutionalized power and authority will do to it. And so it's not the flower is, the beauty of the flower is fading. That's not what God's saying here. The flower, he's not talking about flowers. And he's not talking about something withering from the heat of the sun or lack of water.
Right.
This is the reproductive part of Ephraim and the covenant. It's constantly talking about its Zerah seed and the descendants and inheritance, all which has to do with reproduction and growth. As a matter of fact, it all has to do with the noon, right? The
inherited
letter, yeah, which is the sperm, the child born with an inheritance, and that's the first letter of this next word. This foolishly fades away.
But the fading word, Nawal, is it Nawal, Nawal? You know, that's also a man falling down.
Mm-hmm.
That's another translation of that. But it's not just the fading. I mean, it's
yeah.
If you look
it means
up,
to fall down. Yeah, Nawal means to fall down.
Fall down, yeah.
Right. And it's not just to fall down. It's to fall down in a stupor.
Right.
It's to trip because you were stupid. To be tripped up because, you know, if you're a Muslim today, that's the stupidest religion on the planet. I know it has rivals in Mormonism and rivals in Scientology for most stupid religion. But for a broad-based religion, there is no religion on the planet more stupid than Islam.
Well, my take on that is you can be stupid towards a religion and just die and cease to exist.
Right.
When you become a jihadist and you have become a mass murderer and a mass rapist and all this sort of thing, you're going over there. Some real consequences.
Yeah, there's some real consequences.
That's Sheol. Mm-hmm. You're visiting Sheol.
Yeah,
with Paul and everybody else. So.
Yeah, you're gonna meet Allah.
Oh yeah,
for darn sure. But you know, here we're talking about someone who is dishonored, disgraced,
mm-hmm.
because they became senseless, and as senseless, they became vile. They treated Yahweh's Torah with contempt, and so, rather than respect, and they withered away, ceasing to exist. They were played for a fool. The ball means all of that. It means that people were played for a fool. That Pauline Christianity is playing someone for a fool. I was played for a fool. I know what it's like. I was one of them. Yeah, I was a active Republican. I mean, I was played for a fool by my party, by patriotism, by religion. You know, Kirk, as we're talking about this, I've got some guys that have just reopened my fountain. I have a fountain that goes into the pool that's in the backyard of this home in Ohio. And it caused me to think about back in the time that I was an evangelist.
Mm-hmm.
The leader of our program would encourage us to go into shopping malls where they had one of those internal fountains,
mm-hmm.
and to try to engage people in conversation. And, you know, we're citing Paul for the most part, and statements from the Psalms out of context, not Psalms so much as Isaiah out of context, but mostly Pauline citations, because there was there's kind of a tranquil, soothing, feel-good sound that the fountain made that caused people to be more receptive.
And there's a metaphor backdrop there, too, and, you know, living waters and all that sort of thing. But mm-hmm. you know that commercial yesterday? I'm surprised you didn't jump on it. It was the one about teach your children the songs and the Psalms. Not teach your children. That's the way I put it. They have put them to music.
Mm-hmm.
And the lady comes on and she says, "Gosh, this really works with your kids. It calms them right down." And the only thought I had was, "Well, why don't you just sit down with them and explain what the words to the song meant?"
Right.
Instead of having somebody put it to music and to calm the savage beast.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we did that in our kids' classes. We used to play Beethoven and stuff in the background, and it does calm people down, but that's not the point. The Psalms weren't written so you could calm your children down.
No. No, the Psalms were written so you could teach your children.
Teach your children, yeah.
Right. And that's one of the advantages, by the way, of us doing this, is that we can teach our children, and they can teach their children, and many people come to know Yahweh. So it says, then, this is all just symbolic, explaining what we just read in blunt terms. So then the flower's desirability and honor foolishly fades away.
Right.
The people are played for a fool. They stupidly become worthless. They become imprudent and immoral. They shrivel up and they die. Which, beneficially, by way of relationship, was a Valley of Olives. So he's making the contrast from this this reproductive part of the plant, the attractive part of the plant, the desirable part of the plant, foolishly fading away, being tripped up, and then contrasting it to what it once was, because he's using Ephraim as the symbol, just as Christianity lugs around the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. They claim their authority based on the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Ephraim was a descendant of Jacob and Abraham. And so he's saying, you know, the way it ought to have been, the way it was established initially, is you were a Valley of Olives. What in the world does he mean by a Valley of Olives? First of all, the word Torah, it doesn't just mean teaching, instruction, and guidance, does it?
No.
Isn't it the source from which teaching, guidance, and instruction flow?
That's where we call it Jerusalem.
That's why it's Jerusalem, Yaru, the basis of Torah. Yara, Torah, is the basis of it, speaks of the source from which guidance and direction flow. This conduit from which life flows. You know, he spoke of foolishly. The channel from which enlightenment comes to us, flows forth. Life, the reproductive nature of Yahweh's covenant, and the enlightenment and empowerment and the enrichment that he provides on Shavuah, it's a Valley of Olives. All of the symbolism, this channel from which everything associated with the olive flows. Olive is the oldest lived tree in throughout that region, longest lived tree.
Now, that's translated. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No,
I was going to say it's translated as, you know, a lot of times it's of the fat, and the fat being the oil, of course, and you have all the symbols of the olive. But it was interesting. I looked a little deeper. And there's another meaning in there also of that word, shaman or shiman.
Right.
The meaning is it also describes, is used in ancient times as a fat bull. Obviously, fat being enlarged bull that casts off and breaks the yoke. I thought that was interesting. That's exactly what we're talking about. These people, they've got a big head, and now they're going to break off from Yahweh.
Yeah.
And
times are different, and so I don't typically use the fat connotation anymore. But when we return, let's explain why fat was appropriate for that time, and how fat is only inappropriate for us based on some very narrow and very recent criterion. But let's go back to what fat meant and why fat is still important today. Sounds to me, Kirk, that you don't need all this Yahweh stuff if you want to feel good. You cure malaria with whatever that product was being sold in the last commercial from Dr. Bill. I mean, you just you take a swig of it and
you
know, your malaria's gone. I mean, why not call it
malaria?
A cure?
It took me weeks, and I was in Bangkok. I was laid in a hotel room for weeks and weeks and weeks.
No. Malaria is the worst experience I have ever had in life. The only thing that I could say was close to malaria, and malaria is when you first come down with it, the fevers cause you to be so cold that you bundle up and you kind of go into fetus position. You can't even open your arms and legs. You're freezing to death even though you're burning up. And the pain of that is just excruciating because you're internally, the membranes of your cells are erupting. They're exploding is how malaria creates this fever, is it blows up your cells. And the severity of it lasts for, it's an intense period, is 2 or 3 days where you just as soon be dead. But then it lingers on in the body and reoccurs really every month thereafter for years, the repercussions of malaria. It is a really nasty disease. And this idea that you're going to take an alkaline pill and it's going to rid your body of malaria. I'm here to tell you.
If you believe that, then go ahead and take the pill and when you still suffer from malaria, make sure that you realize that it didn't work.
Right. I would say the one thing that was actually more painful for me was when I had retired from Value America, and I retired as CEO of the company at a board meeting because of the fact that there's a group of the managers that I'd hired that presented a plan to the board that I thought was asinine. And I presented a plan to the board that I thought would work. The board chose the asinine plan. And I said, I don't want any part of this. I know what this is going to do. It's going to make this, the company's going to fall. And so I left the company. And a few months later, a cover story came out in Business Week blaming me for the path the company had chosen. I had nothing to do with it. I mean, I was wholly and completely opposed to it. And I remember how awful. That was probably the worst I'd ever felt in my life. Worse than malaria. Mm-hmm. Is to be publicly and internationally slandered and debased, presented with an account of you that's wholly different than who you are and what you stood for. I mean, there were 77 statements that were part of the article. All 77 were false. Today now I look back on that and I'm glad it occurred. I can't tell you I'm glad that I got malaria. Although, yeah, I guess I can tell you I'm glad I got malaria, because if I hadn't got malaria, it kept me off the plane where Abu Nidal was the first act of Islamic terrorism and brought down the plane, and all 77 people died that were on the plane that I was ticketed on, that I couldn't fly because I was so weakened. So I guess I say, you know, I'm glad I got malaria. But I'm really glad that the Business Week cover story on me came out, because it did two things for me. It put me in a position where I didn't give a crap anymore. Just didn't care. I didn't care what people said about me. I was put into a position where that no matter what somebody wrote, no matter what they said, I didn't care anymore. That's a really important position. Again, if you're going to share Yahweh's testimony,
mm-hmm.
you better be in a position where you do not care what people say about you.
Tough skin.
You got a really tough skin. And the way that you do that is it just doesn't bother you. And no matter what they say, I don't read anything that's written about me. I don't care. Now, the second thing that it did is it gave me a Hosha experience, Hosea experience.
Mm-hmm.
When Hosha was asked to marry the temple prostitute and to see what Yahweh felt when when Ephraim became religious, so that Hosha could say, this is what it's like to be married to a whore. And expose God's feelings towards Ephraim.
Mm-hmm.
By being publicly slandered in one of the grand institutions of the business world, Business Week magazine,
mm-hmm.
and having everything that I had said and done inverted to being the opposite of what I had said and done, and to be wrongly ascribed to things that I had no part of. Well, how do you think that Yahweh feels?
Yeah.
In the face of religions like Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, which are ascribed to him, associated with him, but bear no resemblance whatsoever to him?
I can see him. I can see his little blood vessels in his.
Yeah. Pocket. It took me months to recover. I mean, yeah. I never left my farm for months. I was depressed.
Wow.
I was really depressed. Huh. And it took me a long time to recover. And you know how I finally recovered?
I don't know which stage that was in your life, but I mean, you
probably... I wasn't part of the covenant back at this time. But it was an experience that led me to the covenant. I recovered...
By reading?
By writing. I recovered by being more prolific. So I wrote the book In the Company of Good and Evil. I told the story of who I really was and what I had done. So I just simply explained the truth. And it It was therapeutic. I didn't care if anybody ever read the book.
Mm-hmm.
Just sharing the truth, expanding on what who I really was and what I had really done and those around me, what we had collectively done, was the path to normalcy, for feeling positive again. So back at the time that Yahweh is dealing with Ephraim, he, I'm certain, was depressed because, you know, throughout the book of Yashaya, God says, you know, I looked for somebody that I could work with, that I could convey my message. I couldn't find anybody. I couldn't find anybody. And it struck me that that he found additional prophets rather than giving up. You know, I didn't give up.
No.
He continued to tell his story. This is who I really am. This is what I'm offering. And he ultimately brought us a diminished manifestation of himself, the living embodiment of his Torah, Yahusha, to say, this is who I am. This is what I'm offering. He did the same thing, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He probably got a little depressed when he had to kick Adam and Shaw out, too.
Oh, I'm sure.
He probably had a moment of,
right?
Oh.
In fact, when he had to create the Ark to save humankind and reboot humanity, he even said, I was depressed. He said, I was depressed. I was sorry that I had created humanity. I was sorry that I had. I was depressed. Now, you may not want to view God as getting depressed, but he absolutely, he's saddened by it. Depressed by it. And what's interesting is the solution that worked for me is the same one that he deployed. And that ultimately, the recovery was completed when I began to study what he had to say, learn from it, and then began to share it. That was the going from depressed to neutral was sharing the story, getting back on level footing. And then coming to understand his testimony and his plan and his nature and then sharing it, then was the that great stairway to all of the enlightenment and benefits of heaven itself. It's a complete joy, complete comfort. You know, it's not that I don't care what somebody else says about me. Well, I don't. It's just that on the 1 to 10 scale of things that are meaningful, it's not even a 1.
Mm-hmm.
All the joy and the enthusiasm, the excitement, the benefits associated with the covenant are so overwhelming. And the benefit of just doing what we're doing now. And the enjoyment of it is so comprehensive that that somebody nipping at the ankles is a mosquito.
Who would change positions in this stage? Nobody I know in this family.
No.
No, they're thrilled to be here. I don't care what I did to get here.
Right, right. Oh, yeah. It's just thrilled to be here.
This is thrilling, yes.
Yeah, it's thrilling to be here. And you know, part of you says, why in the world am I committed to trying to convince other people to walk out of religion and embrace this when God's offering, you know, Larry says constantly, the best game in town. I mean, mm-hmm. What God's offering is just so overwhelmingly beneficial. There are no negatives associated with it. It's just so astronomically beneficial. You know, you wonder why it even needs to be presented, much less, you know, have us devoted ourselves to conveying it.
Mm-hmm.
But the intoxication of religion is a tough nut, man.
Boy, I'll say.
So, you know, he's talking about that this had first and foremost been a valley of olives, and the olive is symbolic of the olive oil, the light of the olive oil, particularly that would glow from the menorah, the 6+1 light stand that explains everything you need to know about God, who he is. And by the way, the top of that light stand, those the seven candles, and they're not candles in the sense of wax, they're luminaries that burn olive oil. What were they framed in the shape of? Do you know?
Well, they're curved, and it's it's like a lantern and a lamp.
No, you know, he gives very specific. I mean, this is a detail, and listen, I am lousy with the details, so I don't feel bad for not knowing the detail, because it's likely that I would miss 90%. Because the details are, while they're fascinating, it's the big picture that we love. Flowers. Flowers.
Wow.
The tops of the menorah, where the olive oil is illuminated, is in the shape of flowers.
I'll go back and look.
Right. So then the flower's beauty fades. Mm. And when you speak of the word for flower, T-S-Y-T-S, which is the signpost, mm-hmm. put on the way by Yahweh, and it's you
not
read the cool. Same, yes, the same forward and backwards. You know, the T-S-Y-T-S, this is the signpost along the way established by the very hand of God, that word means to gleam, to sparkle, to shine.
Wow.
It's the flower of the menorah. That's the part that emits the light of the olive oil. As it relates to the religious institutions and those intoxicated by them, is not only this light that comes from the flower. Now, I think he is absolutely referring to the blossom that makes the top of the menorah. And aren't the tubes of the menorah lamp channels for oil?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And and the menorah not only shows Yahweh in the center as one of the lights.
Right.
There's three lights on either side, so it's 6+1, isn't it?
6+1 once again.
Yep. Yeah. So you got 7 lights, and but not just 7 by itself. They're
in unison.
You got one in the middle, and it's 6+1. Man, in addition to God, is God's idea of perfection. And so it says that this valley of light is, first and foremost, is overcome. It's struck down with intoxication. We have intoxication again, but this time a different word. Yin. So if you want to eliminate the beauty of your attractiveness to God, if you want to debilitate your position of status with God, if you want to trip up and be forgotten and foolishly stumble, if you no longer want to be a channel for the cleansing, the immortal, and the healing and enlightening aspects of being a channel for the set apart spirit, being represented by the olive, then intoxication is the way it's going to happen. It'll shut it down. Ephraim lost its ability to be a channel of all the benefits of God's enlightenment and nourishment and immortality, because they were intoxicated with religion. Intoxication is what did it to them.
Now, the word you're referring to is halam, halam.
Well, the word overcome and struck down was, it was halam, H-H-L-M.
And I looked that up,
mm-hmm.
and it's some interesting things that if you dig through enough mm-hmm. lexicons, besides just being to beat, to strike, and to smite, you know, or to be...
Yeah, beaten into submission. That's really an interesting
and it's,
thought.
And it's like with a hammer, too. It's referred
right.
to with a hammer.
Right. But if you're beaten into submission, aren't we talking about what happened with the beast that was Imperial Rome mm-hmm. emerging as the Roman, Holy Roman Empire, the Roman Catholic Church?
Yeah,
beat
yeah.
people into submission.
Oh yeah, they struck them till they gave up.
Right.
But besides that, it also means to dissolve and to be scattered, which is what the tribes wind up being.
Right.
Even though they're the northern tribes first being scattered before they before later they.
Don't you need to concentrate olive oil for it to burn? If you were to take olive oil and spread it over the ground, are you going to get it to light?
No.
No.
Not that flammable. No.
No.
But there's one last little thing in there.
Uh-huh.
There's also, that word is also used as a metaphor for smitten by wine.
Wow.
I mean, it's just the I don't want to say redundancy, but the over and over and over. If you really study the words,
mm-hmm.
is and I know everybody doesn't mm-hmm. like to do this like you and I do,
mm-hmm.
but if you really really study the words and you dig them out, you cannot miss the message.
Right. As a matter of fact,
on one level, hits you on the other.
To be fair, we're not the fastest learners. We like to think we are, but we're not.
We don't even like to think we are.
No, I don't even think I am.
Well, no, I'm saying that humans like to think they are.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But you know that halam, if you look up halam in any one of your lexicons, you know what the word, the first noun directly next to it is in most lexicons?
To beat?
Halal.
Oh, halal. Yeah.
Halal.
Telling, isn't it?
Yes. Oh. Halam and halal are related. And halal is the name that Yahweh afforded Satan.
The Lord that beats you down.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so this is an association with Satan. But it is what happened with Roman Catholicism and how it grew. It was stupid. It was boastful. And it broke the back of all rebellion and then trampled the world into submission.
Could you sell Roman Catholicism without a stronghold of an army to do it to begin with? They have the whole history has an army associated with it.
No, because
it
was
a political army.
No, Theodosius imposed it in the feudal system with lords and serfs.
Right.
The empowered, the cleric and king were empowered. The people, they were disempowered. They became, in essence, slaves. They took the people right back to Egypt. And they did so for 1,000 years. Yahweh wants you free of these things. Are you listening to him?